When you think about the most complicated relationships in your life right now, maybe you think about the one with your teenage daughter. I often do that. Maybe you think about the one with your spouse or with a colleague or with the friend who just asked you to be in her wedding. I would argue that your relationship with money is really, really high on that list because far too few of us have ever taken the time to really look at it. And if you're looking for proof on that, just think about the last time that you indulged in a little retail therapy.
That was today's show financial editor and 11-time best-selling author Jean Chatsky. And this is Best Breakouts from the Conferences for Women, an audio series that offers timeless insights from our archives to help you advance at work and in life. In this session, Your Money, A Pathway to a Richer Life, Jean Chatsky offers tactical solutions to help you get paid what you deserve, make your money last, leave a rich legacy, and feel less stress about it all. We hope you enjoy it.
I am thrilled to be here with all of you. What a big room we're in. Oh my goodness. I actually thought I would start by asking all of you a question. And here it is. What do you want from your money? I mean, what do you really want your money to do for you? And while you think about it, I am going to tell you a story. So about a decade ago now, I wrote a best-selling book called Make Money, Not Excuses. It was pink, like all the other female-focused personal finance books of its time. And it was aimed at convincing women like us that it was just time to step up and take control of our finances. And we needed to do this because at least for the foreseeable future, we were going to under-earn men. We were going to be the ones who took breaks from the workforce to care for our kids and our parents. And those things would put us behind when it came to saving for retirement. And then we were going to go on and outlive those spouses by a good 7 years. So you put all of that together, and what it meant was that 90% of us would at some point be responsible for handling our finances all by ourselves. And there was no getting around the fact that we would be so much better off if we could learn these things before a crisis hit, before we were grieving, before we were under tremendous pressure. And the book did really well. Women loved it. I still see copies every once in a while that somebody has passed along with dog-eared pages. But things have changed in the last decade, and not just a little bit. Today, although we have yet to close the salary gap for good, we have more money. Women have more money. About 38% of us are the primary breadwinners for our families. And that's not the only demographic change going on. More than 50% of women are single by choice. And the number of primary breadwinners who are women soars to 60%. And there is no stopping this train. For every 100 men who graduated from college last year, 132 women graduated. And those college degrees, they will drive increased earnings and increased power for women. Women are poised to inherit 70% of the $41 trillion in intergenerational wealth that will be transferred in the next couple of decades. And it's not, by the way, that our parents prefer us to our brothers, although mine certainly do. It's that we're going to inherit twice. We're going to inherit both from those parents and from those husbands that we will outlive. So you add all of this up and what you get is astonishing. What you get is that by 2028, women will control 75% of the spending, the discretionary spending around the globe. And by 2030, 66% of America's wealth. What has changed even more dramatically, though, is the answer to the question that I asked you. What do we want from our money? What do we want it to do for us? First and foremost, for women, the life that we want to create is the target. For many men, it is the other way around. And there are other marked differences too. We are more concerned than men about both political and economic issues, and we are willing to throw money at those issues in order to create change. We're more concerned than men about the financial stability of our kids and our grandkids, and in particular, making sure that college is in the cards for them. We're more concerned about leaving a legacy for the families and communities and causes that we care about. We're more concerned about using our money to help others. And we're more concerned about making sure that we don't outlive our money. Seriously, this fear is so great that one piece of research showed women are more worried that we will outlive our money than we are of dying, which is why to take all this extra money that is coming our way and put it into the same playbook that men have used for decades, it just doesn't work because we're different. And this is something that I know because I spent the last 2 years of my life doing the research for this new book. I started by talking to hundreds of women and asking them the same question that I asked you over and over and over again. So once I got all those answers, then I put on my reporting hat and I started digging in deeper with economists and psychologists and behaviorists and financial planners to formulate a plan to make all of those things possible. And so today, that's where we're going to begin. That's where we're going to focus so that you can go through the process of assessing the possibilities in your own lives. And in order to do that, what I learned is that before we can focus on what women want, we have to focus on what women need. In 1943, a not yet famous psychologist named Abraham Maslow wrote a paper entitled A Theory of Human Motivation. And that paper included the world's first look at this pyramid, this hierarchy of needs. And Maslow essentially argued that we have to satisfy the needs at the bottom of the pyramid first, the ones that are tied to our survival for warmth and food and clothing before we move to the upper levels where we can focus on things like fulfilling relationships and doing work that makes us feel valued and accomplished and achieving our full potential. And what I learned is that his theory still holds up because for women, before we can move on to the things we need to get the things we need, and what we need, it turns out, is safety. We need safety. We need security. We need stability. Time and time again, the women that I talked to spoke about not just this desire for a home, but a desire for a home with a paid off mortgage. And not just a car, but a car with blind spot indicators and backup cameras and every possible airbag. And for substantial savings, not money in the markets, but actual cash in the bank. And what it made me realize was that despite being a so-called financial expert, I'm really, really typical. When I got divorced a little over a decade ago and it became really clear that I was going to become the one to move, to leave our family home and go live somewhere else, I was laser focused on buying a house and making it into a place where my kids would be just as comfortable when they were with me as they were when they were with their dad. And never mind that it was 2005 and real estate prices were up to here. Never mind that renting would have made so much more financial sense. I would not hear of it because to me, that didn't feel secure. I also seriously curbed my spending and ramped up my savings because nothing made me feel as safe or as secure as signing on to my bank online and seeing that the balance was actually growing. And when I opened my garage door every morning, there still sits a Volvo wagon. And nothing says safety and security like a Volvo, unless it's a Volvo wagon. This longing for safety and security, it's understandable. For women feeling safe in our surroundings, it's not something that we are able to take for granted. And it's not just that 90% of the victims of rape and sexual assault are women, or that women are more likely to be the victims of stalking. It is much, much more basic than that. From the year 2006 to 2017, the Gallup organization measured how safe people feel walking home at night in their own communities. And what they found was that just 64% of women said that they feel safe versus almost 90%. Of men. And what's interesting is that throwing money at this problem doesn't help. When you looked at the top 1/5 of women in terms of their economic status, only 70% of them said that they felt safe walking home at night. And our hold on financial security seems just as tenuous. After a divorce, it's 1 in 5 women who fall into poverty. After retirement, men believe that their money will last as long as they do. Women think ours is going to run out 5 years too early. And yet there is a big problem with this need for safety and security. It actually stands in the way of financial stability. Let's go back for a second to that cash in the bank. According to some research from BlackRock, women keep about 71% of our assets in cash. Men keep about 60%. Over the last decade, do you know what that money in the bank has done for you? Yeah, bupkis. You put $1,000 into the bank a decade ago, you have $1,010. Go buy a pizza and have a party, right? But if instead we had invested that money, putting it into a balanced mutual fund with average returns, that $1,000 would have become $3,000. And if we added to that every single time we got paid, that is how we build long-lasting wealth. And investing isn't the only area where this bias towards safety holds us back. When we take the safe route in our careers because we don't either want to face rejection or the sort of backlash that women sometimes face when we are seen as too successful, we are doing the very same thing and we have to stop. It is time to stop doubting ourselves, to stop overanalyzing because due to all of these demographic trends, due to the fact that the seas are changing and more money is coming our way, we have an opportunity for the first time to build a life that is full of purpose and joy, and by the way, safer and more secure simultaneously. And to do it, we need to go through 3 steps. The first is understanding who you are in relation to your money. When you think about the most complicated relationships in your life right now, maybe you think about the one with your teenage daughter. I often do that. Maybe you think about the one with your spouse or with a colleague or with the friend who just asked you to be in her wedding. I would argue that your relationship with money is really, really high on that list because far too few of us have ever taken the time to really look at it. And if you're looking for proof on that, just think about the last time that you indulged in a little retail therapy. What happened that sent you shopping? Did you have a bad day at work? Did you have a fight with someone? Or was it the opposite? Were you celebrating something? What made you reach for your credit card? Here's the thing. Human beings are emotional creatures. We are emotional. And it's not that emotion is bad, but emotions make us take action. And once we take that action, once we buy that lipstick or whatever, we get this little pat on the back that says, you go, girl, and we do it all again. And there is a lot of emotion around money. This is not just something that we surmise. This is something that we can actually see. Researchers can look at our brains. They do look at our brains in the process of making decisions about money. And what they see is that when something we want comes into view, the pleasure centers in our brains, they light right up. And when we get the item, whatever it happens to be, we get a rush of the feel-good chemical dopamine. The problem with this is that if you delay the availability of that item, of that reward, if you make yourself wait for it, you need to make the reward much, much larger in order to get that same pleasurable reaction from your brain. And things that are way off in the future, like retirement, they don't light up our brains at all. By the way, it's not just our emotions that get us in trouble. It is the biological imperative to survive. As a human species, we were designed to survive the day. Our cave women ancestors, they were programmed to just kill it and eat it because they were not sure when another meal was going to come wandering by the mouth of their cave. And unfortunately, we have not evolved as much as we might like to think. And so when we ask ourselves to make a good financial decision to delay gratification rather than go in for that immediate gratification, we are going against our own basic instincts. These are things we now understand a lot more about thanks to the work that's being done in the field of behavioral economics. How many of you have heard of behavioral economics? Yeah, awesome. It's fascinating. Investopedia defines behavioral economics as the study of psychology as it relates to the economic decision-making processes of individuals and institutions. I define it as the study of why smart people do stupid things with money. Biology plus emotion can be this very tough 1-2 punch to overcome, but we can do it if we understand where we're coming from. And at the risk of putting us all on the couch, that means you have to go back to childhood. How you feel about money today, how you behave with money today, it is directly related to the feelings that you absorbed about money when you were growing up. And it's not what you were taught. It's what you heard. It's what you absorbed. It's the fact that there was always tension around payday or when the credit card bill arrived. It's the fact that there was sadness rather than joy around the holidays. In reporting this book, I held a series of what we at Her Money call Her Money Happy Hour. I gather anywhere from about a half a dozen to 50 women together. We pull questions out of a deck of cards, and we start talking about money. We also open a few bottles of wine because when you are talking about money, wine helps. And Women love these things. They use words like empowering and liberating, but I love it too because it gives me a window into a huge array of money histories, of money stories. This is Alyssa's. Alyssa said, "My dad is a financial planner. That's his job. But he raised us with values of poverty. Whenever we were going to play a game of Ms. Pac-Man, he'd say, might as well just throw that money in a ditch. I thought we were on the verge of food stamps. One night, we went to the Dairy Queen, and everyone kept coming up to him and talking to him. And it turned out he owned the Dairy Queen. We spent the weekend going to garage sales. I had no idea. And so even now, even though we're doing just fine, I always feel broke." That's a money story. Here's one more. This is Virginia's. She says, "When I was 9, we moved to a pretty ritzy suburb. In my old neighborhood, everyone was middle class or working class. When we moved, the kids had different brands of things. I had the wrong sneakers and the wrong backpack. It took me a while before I understood what I was really supposed to want. I think that middle school stuff gave me a template for my feelings today. If I have a big work meeting, I'm going to go out and buy something new to wear, probably. There's a sense of wanting to feel that I can throw money at a problem and solve it that way." Nobody taught these things to Alyssa or Virginia. They were just in the air. And to figure out what your money story is, it requires asking yourself some pointed questions. Questions like, what was the feeling about money like in the home where you grew up? What's your earliest memory of money? What messages did your parents pass down? Do you remember your parents fighting about money? Do you remember tension in the air? Once you know your story, and if you're in a relationship, it's really, really helpful to know your significant others as well. Once you know it, you can deal with it. You can't unsee it. You can't wish it away, but you can choose to take your life in another direction by dealing with it. Alyssa dealt with her inability to spend money on herself by setting up a fund specifically for spending money on her. And Virginia makes sure that she saves first so that if she does spend emotionally, she doesn't derail her financial goals. And then you can start asserting more control over all of your money to accomplish your larger goals. And that means investing. How many of you would call yourselves investors? How many of you have 401ks or IRAs? That's the difference. Here's the thing. You're all investors. You just don't feel like it. We think investors are Jim Cramer screaming at the television set. But no. A woman at one of my gatherings outside San Francisco, she put her finger on why. She said, "I don't manage my money each day. I just put it in. I look at the statements and I hope they're going to get the average that they're supposed to get. But to me, that's not an investor. An investor is someone who takes time during the day to look at stocks and see how they're doing and maybe trying to time the market." And I said, "That would make you a bad investor." What Erica described, this woman in San Francisco, is a trader. Like Jim Cramer, traders sell much more frequently, many, many times a day. They try to make money by betting on the markets when they're falling, not just when they're rising. Investing is different. It's long-term. It's slower. It's a process where patience is rewarded, not punished. Trading is a competition. In investing, everyone can get a trophy. And although traders often turn to technical analysis dozens, if not hundreds of times a day, investing can be much, much simpler. There are only three things that determine how successful most investors are. The first and most important is how much you save. We want to be saving at least 15% of whatever we're earning from the time we start working until the time we stop. That can include any matching dollars that you receive from your employer. But generally, if you do that, you'll know that you have enough with Social Security to replace about 85% of your pre-retirement income. And just like you can't out-exercise a bad diet, you can't out-invest your way of a savings shortfall. Savings is the most important thing. It has to come first. It's not negotiable. Second on the list, also hugely important, is asset allocation. This is just your mix of stocks and bonds and cash that you choose to balance risk and reward. This is responsible, and again, this is years and years of research, for about 90% of the return on your money. You want to do it in an easy way? You just put all your money in a target date retirement fund, which fixes the mix based on your age and your distance from your goals, and that's all you have to do. Finally, third on the list, security selection. This is the stocks, the bonds that you pick to put in those asset classes. You buy a target date fund, you never have to do this at all. And one other really important thing to keep in mind is why asset allocation is the driving force. And this is the story. The Dow Jones Industrial Average has gone up about 8% a year since its inception. The S&P 500 has gone up 10% a year since its inception. If you decide that you are just fine with those returns, and by the way, I am just fine with those returns, then again, all you have to do to be successful is to put your money into simple index funds, low cost, highly diversified, or to go the target date route, and then you can call it a day. And this not only works, this explains why research shows women are better investors than men. Men trade 35% more frequently than we do. They dip in and out of stocks. They meddle, and it costs them. Women don't. We save more than men do, about 0.4% more each year. Because we don't meddle, we earn more than men do, about 0.4% each year. Add all of this together over the course of a career, it can easily add another $250,000 to a retirement portfolio. But I don't think that we can leave this topic of investing until we talk a little bit about risk. Risk is why when I ask, are you an investor, I see hands go up kind of tentatively. In investing, there are no guarantees. There are no perfect answers. I can't guarantee that you're going to score 100 or that you're going to get an A+. And that is really, really tough for good girls like me, and I know like many of you, who like to know the right answer to every question before we ask it. We're just not wired that way. The thought that we could lose money rather than make it can be downright terrifying, which is why I come back to those historical returns. If you're okay with an average 8 to 10% a year, you just keep putting money in, you diversify, and you let it do your work. And the reason that this is so important is because as of today, that salary gap, it still exists. As of the current pace of change right now, we're not going to close it until the year 2119. I know. But we can do our part to speed up the clock individually. And we do that by asking for more money for us. Only 7% of women negotiate for that first job offer out of college. 57% of men do. But what you learn when you ask, and especially if you can get yourself to start asking repeatedly, is that it gets easier. And here's the thing. Getting paid is good. Getting paid more is better. It is better. Not earning up to our potential, it's not good for anyone. It's not good for our families or our kids or the younger women in our orbit who are following every move that we make, or frankly, society as a whole, because research has shown women who do earn more, we are more likely to learn about our finances, to take control of them, and to be confident about the actions that we do take. And when that extra money shows up in our bank accounts and in our brokerage accounts, it manifests the other things that women want from our money. And they are pretty terrific. Once we get past safety and security, once we get past asking for more and investing for tomorrow, here's what we want. We want to buy homes. Who wants to buy a home? Stand up. And by the way, we want to buy homes whether or not we have a partner to share them with. Today, single women with kids and without kids account for twice as many home purchases as single men. Yes, amazing. We want to start businesses. Stand up if you want to start a business. Right now, 900 women hang out a shingle every day in the United States. The rate at which women are launching businesses is 1.5 times the rate that men do. We want to help our kids not only launch, but flourish. Stand up if you want to help your kids. And although I wish I did not have to say this in 2019, we have to be really careful that we are giving our daughters the same messages about money that we are giving our sons. Because research shows that a lot of people are talking more about financial goals with sons. And more sons are aware that their parents are saving for college for them. If we expect our daughters to be less capable, they will be. We want to help our parents. Stand up if you want to help your parents. As our parents age, this is going to become more and more important. We want to leave a legacy on the causes and the communities that we care about. And one of the things that I think is so great about this power shift into the hands of women is the ability that it's going to give us to change the world. And finally, and this should get every last one of you on your feet, we want nice stuff. And there is nothing wrong with nice stuff. Anna, who is a lawyer in Philadelphia, came to one of her money happy hours. She's about 50 years old, and she drew the card that read, "I spend money because." And she thought for a minute, and she read the room. And she said, "I spend money because I can. And it feels effing awesome." Anna had been through a very, very tough divorce. Her husband had racked up 6 figures in credit card debt, half of which, yes, I know, was hers to repay when they split up. She fought her way back. And now when she spends with joy. In my house, we say, this is why we work. I say it when I spend too much on tickets to Hamilton. I say it when I am getting my hair blown out, even if I have nowhere to go. There can be a weird morality around spending. Sometimes we look at other people's purchases. Sometimes we look at what they're choosing to do with their money, and we think it's okay to judge them. Well, no, not here. Not on my podcast, not on the hermoney.com website, not in our private Facebook group where we have conversations like this every single day. And by the way, you should all join us. If you are not a member of the Her Money community, if you will take out your phone and text Her Money, one word, H-E-R-M-O-N-E-Y, to 888-111, we will get you all signed up. Because at Her Money, we know that we are happiest if we use our money in a way that lines up with our values. Like many, many women, I have been helped immeasurably by the role models in my life, none more so than my own mother. I learned from my mom how to balance a checkbook, which for the record, I haven't done in a decade. I learned how to make an amazing chicken soup. But maybe most importantly, I learned that if you're going to have an important conversation with your kids, you should do it in the car. You should be driving, by the way, so that you do not have to look at them. But you know that you have a captive audience. And so over the years, this is where I talked about important, difficult topics with my teenagers. This is where I talked about drugs and drinking and sex. So a few years ago, I was about to embark on one of these conversations with my son. He was in high school at the time. I had heard rumors of kids starting to hook up. And although I was pretty sure that he wasn't one of them, I felt it was on me to make sure that he had all of the pertinent information. And so I got in the car and I buckled my seatbelt and I pulled away from the curb and I just launched in, explaining that I wanted to be sure that he knew everything he needed to know about condoms and STDs. And he said, "I got it, Mom." And I said, "What do you mean you got it? Where did you learn all of these things?" And he said, "Friends." And I said, "Your friends?" I was pretty sure that he wasn't getting any action, but I knew that his motley crew was getting even less. And he said, and I will never forget this, he said, "No, Mom, friends, Ross, Rachel." Mm-hmm. He was totally right. Totally right. You turn on Friends. My husband and I, we just streamed the entire series on Netflix. You get a full course in sex education. And drugs and drinking, they are covered in a lot of the health classes and the DARE programs in our schools. But you know what's not covered? Money is not covered. We don't talk about money at home. Many of us don't talk about money with our significant others. We don't talk about money at school. And as a result, we are not as comfortable talking about money as we need to be. But we can get there. We can absolutely get there if we just open up and talk to one other person, one other woman about it. I know just by the fact that you are sitting in this room, that you are all here, not just for yourselves, but you are here for each other. The amazing Madeleine Albright likes to say that there is a special place in hell for women who don't help other women. I love that quote, and I truly believe it, because if we work together, if we lift each other up and cheer each other on, we clear the way, not just for ourselves, but for the next generation of women with money. And this is how revolutions begin. So thank you so much for listening to me. Thank you very, very much. I'm going to bring Michelle back up, and I am happy to answer any of your questions. Thank you.
Hi, Jean. Thanks for coming.
Sure.
So one of the things that I'm always confused about when it comes to how much to save, how much to invest in everything, is that I have tons of student debt. So how do you find the balance of how much you should save versus debt you should pay off?
Yeah, I think there are probably a ton of people here who are in the very, very same situation. When we look at these things, we look at the returns on our money. And the way to evaluate that is to know that when you pay off a debt, the return on your money is equal to the interest rate minus any tax deduction. When you pay off a credit card at 25%, that's like putting 25% in your pocket. When you pay off a mortgage at 4%, where there might be a tax deduction as well, it's like putting 3% in your pocket. And student loans are somewhere in the middle, 6, 7, 8%, depending on what type of loans you have. And so the way to look at these returns is to try to reduce the interest rate that you're paying on your student loans overall. You can look into refinancing, or if your payments are not palatable, but you have federal loans, you can look at income-based repayment programs, which clears the way to grab the very best returns on your money, which is free money from your employer in the 401k match. So in a way, we want to compartmentalize our student loans, put them over here, pay them off on the schedule that you've got once you reduce your interest rates as much as possible, but don't stress about paying them off early. You're better off in the long term if you invest in your 401k and you let your money grow on another track rather than getting all wrapped up in, oh my God, I got to clear the decks of these student loans tomorrow.
Hello. I was wondering how people should balance being financially independent, like hopefully much earlier than retirement, and working in a field where you're not necessarily economically valued. Like I work in environmental protection and it's not the economy's favorite field.
So. I work in journalism, so I get it.
Yeah.
It's a tough question to answer because you're asking two questions at once. I think it's important to separate the personal satisfaction that you get from working in your field against, keep that on a different track almost than the salary. Because although there may be ways to boost your compensation over the long term, if working in this field is something that you feel completely passionate about and like it's something that's very tied up in who you are and what you want to give back to the world, then it's perhaps not as much about the money. These are choices that we make. And if you at some point decide, I'm not feeling satisfied by doing this, I do feel like it's about the money, which is a fine decision to make, then you go back and you look at opportunities to get into more lucrative careers. But I don't think that you can necessarily expect a society to change around you. You did bring up the words financial independence before retirement. And so I did want to point you in the direction of what's going on in the FIRE movement. The FIRE movement, FIRE stands for Financial Independence Retire Early. And it's basically a very, very large and growing group of people who've decided that they're just going to live very leanly in order to save a greater percent of their income so that they can buy themselves financial independence. And by their calculations, once they have banked 25 times their expenses, they're independent. And at that point, they can choose to work or not work in whatever they want while living life on their own terms. So if that's something that you're interested in, there's a great podcast called Choose FI, Choose Financial Independence. You might want to check it out.
Thank you.
Sure.
I have a quick question about how to get started with investing outside of a 401k. So I have that, but where do you begin outside of that? If you wanted to start investing in stocks or diversifying, as you said, is there a number that I should get to first? It seems like they're like, oh, you got to have 5,000 to start investing on your own. Like,
you know,
where to begin?
No, you can start with $100. You can. It's just a matter of opening a brokerage account. I think it's really beneficial for all of our long-term success that we take advantage of any accounts that give us tax savings first. 401ks and other retirement accounts, health savings accounts, which if you don't need to spend the money in those accounts, you can invest it. It can grow into a supplemental retirement account. 529s if you're trying to save for college for your kids. Above and beyond that, though, you can just open a brokerage account and you can buy a stock or buy a mutual fund. There are many, many firms out there that will allow you to put together a portfolio based on your goals. There are a lot of robo-advisors where the costs are very, very low. if you have your 401k with one of the big firms like Fidelity or Schwab or T. Rowe, you could open an account on the side with one of those. And the advantage of that is that when you sign on to your benefits portal, you'll not just see your retirement account, you'll see this as well. And it allows you to manage it with one login. But you just get going. $100, you want to add to it every single month if you can, just to keep building value. Pick a stock you like, pick a fund you like, watch it. You'll learn a lot and you're on your way.
Thank you.
Hi, Jean. Thank you for being here today.
Sure.
I have a question about where to keep my emergency savings fund. I follow FIRE and I've been struggling with whether to keep it completely liquid or to invest it. I know that I've got credit lines open to me and other ways to deal with emergencies, but what's your recommendation?
Is it really an emergency fund? And the reason that I ask is because there's a new piece of research that shows that women on average have $20,000 just sitting in a bank account, like beyond our emergency fund, earning that 0.1%. So if it really is your emergency fund, then it should be in a bank. But it doesn't have to be in a 0.1% bank. It can be in an internet bank where you're more likely to get closer to 2%, 1.5% to 2%. And those accounts, if you just Google around for the best savings rates, you'll find them. There are a lot of them these days. Capital One has one, CIT, Citizens. There are a bunch of them. And I would make sure that at the very least, you're grabbing that. But as you look at what this money is truly for, if you have your 6 months of living expenses and this is not really money that you're going to use in the short term, then I would say put it in a diversified portfolio that lines up with your long-term goals.
Hi. What are some positive conversations to have in front of your kids preaching about money so they do have a positive experience?
A couple of things that come to mind immediately. I would absolutely start talking with your kids about their individual goals. So what do they want from their money? Kids are getting, I think, an average of $30 a week allowance. A lot of kids are working. I think working for high school kids is really, really important, whether they're babysitting or whether they have a job where they get an actual paycheck. I can tell you from my own kids, they got allowance for years and then they started working and the money that they earned was so much more valuable than any money that I gave them. It was insane. But that's sort of when the light bulb comes on for a lot of kids. And then help them figure out how to save and accomplish the goals that they want. That's the positive experience, learning to delay gratification and achieve something. And you may have to help them along the way. At my house, we did a sort of a homegrown 401k for my son when he wanted his first gaming system because on his allowance, which was nowhere near $30 a week, it was going to take him a really long time to get there. The other thing is, I think talk to them about the cost of college early on, what you will be able to contribute, what you won't be able to contribute, how their job is to get good grades and to come up with a list of schools that not just schools they want to attend, but schools that are likely to really, really want them. So they're likely to get more in the way of merit aid. And if investing, if picking stocks and mutual funds is something that you're interested in, bringing them along on that is also really encouraging. Last thing, as we head into the holidays when charitable giving is sort of on the minds of a lot of people, it's nice to involve your kids in that as well and let them help make decisions about where you're going to give.
Thank you for starting the conversation and keeping the conversation going for women to not be so secretive and fearful about money. I appreciate that.
Thanks.
So here's my question. This upcoming recession that we're bound to have since it's out there, how do I stop being fearful about what's happening with my 401k? Because I lived through the 2009 recession and I lost 35%. And my gut is telling me to get everything out of there and put it in a mattress, but I know that can't be true.
So my gut ahead of that told me the same thing and I didn't. And I lost 35% too. But let me ask you a question. Where are you now?
Way better than I was in 2009.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah, but I was 10 years younger then.
No, but you've come way back. The market is up.
That's true.
300% from where it was.
Is that going to happen in 10 more years?
In 2009. You've got time. Okay. Right? I mean, I'm looking at you. I can see you've got a lot of, you've got time.
I'm 60, so I don't know how much time I have.
Okay. Well, then that's an important thing to take in mind. First of all, everybody's now turning around and looking at you because you look fabulous. As we head into retirement and as we age, the amount of risk that we should be taking in our investment goes down, in our portfolio overall goes down. And what that means is that the amount that you should have in stocks now is less than the amount you should have had in stocks 10 years ago and 10 years before that. For anybody who has not rebalanced their investments, gone back and taken a look at the amount of risk and the percentages in stocks in a long period of time, it's a really good time to do that and just make sure that you're taking the amount of risk that you think you're taking. I would say two things. It's a really, really good time for you to sit down with a financial advisor. 5-10 years out from retirement, you want to make sure that you have a plan to maybe convert some of your assets into an income stream that will live as long as you do and that you know how you're going to do that to supplement Social Security. You do want to make sure that you're not taking an inordinate amount of risk. And if you can't sleep, if you're really, really worried, take 5% more off the table. And if that doesn't work, take another out of stocks. And if that doesn't work, take another 5%. Don't take everything because the people who got truly killed by the last downturn in stocks are the ones who took everything out and never got back in again.
Thank you.
Sure.
Jean Chatzky is the award-winning financial editor of NBC Today and creator of Her Money Media, a digital media company focused on improving women's relationships with money. To learn more, please visit hermoney.com. Thanks for listening. We hope you found this session helpful, and we invite you to tune in for more best breakouts from the Conferences for Women.